Welcome to the reading of the Quad City Times for today, Tuesday, April 23rd, 2024. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of people with print disabilities. Your readers today are Dale Finnegan and Doug Kretzinger. And now, here is Doug with our first story.
And we'll begin with this article on the front page of the Quad City Times. City of Davenport settlement with former city administrator Warner. The letter exists. Spiegel's demand letter led to city paying settlement, and this is written by Sarah Watson. The demand letter from former city administrator Corey Spiegel to the city of Davenport absolutely exists, and a copy was provided to Lane and Waterman attorneys in early October, according to Davenport's former city attorney, Tom Warner. A City of Davenport spokesperson confirmed late Monday afternoon that the city has a copy of Spiegel's demand letter and would produce it if ordered to by the courts. Davenport filed suit in February, asking a judge to rule whether the September 15 demand letter from Spiegel was a public record. The letter, which the city says includes allegations of harassment by elected officials and a request for a settlement, prompted the city to pay Spiegel $1.6 million in lieu of a harassment lawsuit. The city named a frequent records requester, David Ezra Cedron, as a defendant in that case because he'd requested the record. The city is not seeking judgment against him. This past week, a December email exchange between a city-contracted Lane and Waterman attorney and Spiegel was made public in a records request, which Cedron has interpreted to mean the letter may not exist. The attorney, Brett Marshall, emailed to Spiegel December 15, asking her to send a copy of the settlement letter because, quote, the city cannot locate a copy of your written settlement request, end quote. Marshall also asked if Spiegel had any documents to respond to an open records request, which asked for emails, letters, memos, and text messages related to Spiegel's departure from the city. Quote, can you let me know whether you have any responsive documents, specifically relevant text messages, and a separation settlement request? I note that the city cannot locate a copy of your written settlement request, so please send me a copy of that with any other responsive documents. End quote. Spiegel responded later that day. Quote, I possess no text responsive to this request, nor did any ever exist. Any other items associated with this request should be in the city's possession via email, electronic file, or paper copy, end quote. Cedron interpreted that exchange to suggest the September 15 letter may never have existed. Cedron, in an email, wrote that he planned to file a motion for sanctions against the city and Lane and Waterman attorneys in the ongoing court case for, in his view, likely filing a spurious lawsuit against Dr. Cedron rather than admit that the city made a $1.6 million payment to the former city administrator without any evidence of harassment or abuse, he said. His motion had not yet shown up on online court documents as of 1 p.m. Monday. Cedron provided a copy of the motion in the email to media. He also wrote that he requested the court order the city to produce Spiegel's letter for an in-camera review, and if the city is not in possession of the document, to dismiss the case. Warner, the former Davenport city attorney who negotiated with Spiegel on behalf of the city, wrote in an email to the Quad City Times that the letter, quote, absolutely exist, and a copy was provided by me to Lane and Waterman in very early October. On December 15, 2023, Brett Marshall asked Corey Spiegel for a copy of her demanded letter. Warren wrote, that's odd, he says. I'm not sure why he would do that when I informed him on December 8, 2023, that a copy was in the possession of the law firm he works for, Lane and Waterman. Further, in my opinion, her letter certainly would have been reviewed by him and others at his firm prior to the December 13 executive session that he attended. The letter absolutely exists, and a copy was provided by me to Lane and Waterman in very early October, end quote. The city on Monday confirmed the existence of Spiegel's demand letter, writing in a news release that the city located a copy of the letter and would produce it to the court for its review if so ordered. Quote, several months ago and prior to filing the initial proceeding, the city did locate a copy of Ms. Spiegel's demand letter and confirmed that a demand existed, end quote. That's what the release stated. The city will provide a copy of the letter to the court for its review if ordered by the court. Marshall declined to comment.
There are two more articles on the front page of the Quad City Times that are more state and national. The headlines for those are Pritzker takes aim at Tier 2 pensions. This is an Illinois article, obviously. It's quite long. And then the other one, arguments start in trial regarding the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. Obviously another national story. So I'm going to turn to the local page and read those. We'll get those stories done first. If we have time, we can get back to the state and national stuff. On the local page, food bank boasts savings. Riverbend reports rescuing 2.1 million pounds of food during 2023. This story is written by Gretchen Teske. For Iowa food banks, every day is Earth Day when it comes to the effort to divert food from landfills and instead put it on the tables of those who are hungry. Monday, the Iowa Food Bank Association announced 27,159,465 pounds of food was rescued in 2023 by the six Feeding America member food banks serving Iowa. The River Bend Food Bank in Davenport is one of those partners. Of that total, about 8% or 2,172,757 pounds of food came from River Bend, said Chief Development Officer Jenny Colvin. At the food bank, the food rescue team is in charge of sourcing food from local retailers and manufacturers. Colvin said education was a big part of outreach. Products in grocery stores are sometimes pulled from the shelves because of new packaging or because it has passed the amount of time it can be on the shelf, even though the food is still fresh. Instead of throwing it away, the River Bend team steps in. She said, we develop relationships with them to make sure the food is coming to the food banks. Locally, Hy-Vee, Sam's Club, Costco, and the Walmart Distribution Center all donate food items to River Bend. The organization as a whole serves 23 counties, with five of those being in Iowa. With a warehouse each in Davenport and Dubuque, and a distribution hub in Galesburg, all donations are collected at those sites to be given to the partnering food banks for distribution. Colvin continued, we say the three things that help support the food bank are food, time, and money, emphasizing the food donations help offset the cost of purchasing more. She continued, it's a really nice partnership collaboration with any retailers and manufacturers that want to support us by donating any excess food. According to the USDA, up to 40% of the U.S. food supply is wasted every year. Food banks rely on retail rescue, donations of food from grocery stores, to meet the growing and record need for food assistance. Colvin said, it's also about keeping it out of the landfills. We tell people the amount of food our whole country throws away on a given year. If we all just stopped throwing away the food we thought was bad, we could solve the hunger problem today, she said. The Iowa Food Bank Association as a whole works with grocery and convenience stores, manufacturers, growers, and restaurants to supplement the inventory and keep pantry shelves stocked. As part of the Iowa Food Bank Association, we collaborate across the state to recover food and help the environment, River Bend COO Chris Ford said, and continued, By getting this food to communities facing hunger, we also prevent millions of pounds from clogging landfills and help mitigate climate change. Our commitment to sustainability will only grow as we strive to meet record demand for food assistance.
Another local story on the page 3 of the Quad City Times. Woman faces more skip scan charges, written by Tom Malloy and Thomas Geyer. An East Moline woman who is facing multiple charges of theft in Scott County District Court for allegedly skip scanning to steal merchandise from the Iowa Quad City Hy-Vee stores is now facing additional charges in Scott and Rock Island counties. On Friday, Linnea Michelle Bennett, 40, was arrested on a Scott County warrant on a charge of ongoing criminal conduct. The charge is a Class B felony under Iowa law that carries a prison sentence of 25 years. On Saturday, Bennett was arrested on a Rock Island County warrant on a charge of retail theft over $300. The charge is a Class 3 felony under Illinois law that carries a prison sentence of 2 to 5 years. In that case, she allegedly used a skip-scanning ploy to steal from the Silva's Hy-Vee store on 16 occasions. According to the arrest affidavits filed by Scott County Sheriff's Department Reserve Deputy Pamela Robertson in connection with the charge of ongoing criminal conduct between November 7, 2023 and January 13, 2024, Bennett went to the Hy-Vee in Silva 16 times. Each of those times, Bennett would go to a self-checkout register and pretend to scan all of the merchandise, but instead would scan only a few of the items. She would then pay only for the items she actually scanned using her EBT or electronic benefits transfer card. For instance, on December 30, 2023, Bennett went to the Hy-Vee in Silvis located at 2001 Fifth Street, according to the affidavit. She put merchandise totaling $285.08 into her cart. She then went to a self-checkout register and scanned in only $23.64 worth of the items. The rest of the items she pretended to scan. She used her EBT card to pay the $23.64 and then left the store. During those 16 trips to the Hy-Vee, Bennett placed items worth $2,304.01 into her cart, but paid for only $577.30 of the merchandise with her EBT card, according to the affidavits. According to the affidavits, during a five-month span between November 7, 2023 and March 22, Bennett visited the Hy-Vee store in Silvis, the store on Devil's Glen Road in Bettendorf, and the stores on West Locust Street, East Kimberly Road, West Kimberly Road, East 53rd Street, and Rockingham Road in Davenport. In the 36 visits she made to those stores, she either skip-scanned items or walked out of the store with merchandise and not paying for anything. According to the affidavits, the amount she skip-scanned totaled $5,168.23, while the total she paid using her EBT card totaled $995.12. She allegedly left the stores without paying for any merchandise on several occasions. According to the affidavits, the loss to Hy-Vee totals more than $4,200. In three of her cases, Bennett also is accused of using her juvenile daughter and her daughter's juvenile boyfriend to aid in the thefts. According to the affidavits, Bennett and her juvenile daughter went to the Hy-Vee store at 3019 Rockingham Road in Davenport, 5:49 p.m. on March 19, court documents state. Bennett and her daughter took items off the shelves totaling $157.79. They left the store with the merchandise without paying. At 3:30 p.m. on March 21, Bennett, her daughter, and her daughter's boyfriend went to the Hy-Vee at 4064 East 53rd Street in Davenport and removed items $5. Bennett paid only $2.69 for the merchandise using her EBT card, court documents state. Bennett was first arrested on the theft charges March 28. She was arrested again on April 2 when additional charges were filed in Scott County District Court. She was arrested Friday on the new Scott County charge and was released after posting bond. She was arrested Saturday on the Rock Island County charge and released on her own recognizance. In addition to the charge of ongoing criminal conduct, Bannard is charged in Scott County District Court with three counts of using a juvenile to commit an indictable offense, a Class C felony that carries a prison sentence of 10 years. She also is charged with one count of second-degree theft, a Class D felony that carries a prison sentence of 5 years, and four counts of third-degree theft, an aggravated misdemeanor, carries a prison sentence of 2 years. Bennett is to be arraigned in district court on four of her Scott County cases on April 25 and the ongoing criminal conduct charge May 9. A preliminary hearing on the theft charge in Rock Island County is scheduled for May 7 in circuit court. According to Rock Island County Circuit Court electronic records, Bennett was convicted of two felony counts of theft. She also has a Class A misdemeanor convictions on three charges of retail theft and one charge of using a forged credit card.
Also from the local page of the Quad City Times, there is a series of photographs in the center of the page, and the headline, or caption rather, at the bottom of the three photos says, "Learning about agriculture." In the top photo, we see FFA, that's Future Farmers of America, member Charlie Edwards talking about hydroponic farming to a group of Illinois City grade schoolers Monday during an interactive ag day at Rockridge High School in Edgington. And you can see Charlie, a young woman who is standing in front of a group of children, and next to her is a table with a poster board, a trifold poster board, where she has a Fork Farms hydroponics presentation with photographs and on the poster board, and then some bottles and pictures on the table as she's talking about what hydroponic farming is about. In the lower left photo, a group of first graders from Illinois City tours the greenhouse during Interactive Ag Day. And you can see there in the greenhouse a big table full of, probably 6-inch-high seedlings. And the table is completely covered with the petals of the plants. You can't tell what they are. And the teachers and students are around the tables looking at the plants. And then the final photo, the lower right photo, is Illinois City first grader Zoe Martin. She's standing at a table wearing her coat but looking down at the table and doing something with her hands and a piece of paper, it looks like, as she prepares seeds to take home and plant after visiting the FFA greenhouse at Rockridge High School. And that all happened on Interactive Ag Day on Monday. The article I will read next is titled "Sager Named Finance Director." This is in Rock Island, and the story is by Grace Kinnicutt. The City of Rock Island has announced Jessica Sager as its new finance director. She has been the interim director since October of 2023, when former director Linda Barnes retired. Sager was hired as the city's finance manager in June of 2022, stated in the city's announcement. "I am honored to be promoted to finance director," Sager said in a news release on Monday. "I look forward to all the exciting projects that are on the horizon and to serving the citizens of Rock Island." She will lead a finance team that has been awarded the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting for 41 consecutive years for the annual Comprehensive Financial Report. The award is issued by the Government Finance Officers Association of the United States and Canada. City Manager Todd Thompson said Sager brought a wealth of professional experience and fiscal achievements to the city. He said, "I am confident she will continue the city's pattern of sound financial management. I am pleased to appoint her finance director." Sager has 19 years of municipal experience and began her career as a municipal court clerk for the City of Cherry Hills Villages in Colorado in 2005, stated in the announcement. There, she worked her way up to Director of Finance and Administration. During her tenure with Cherry Hills Villages, she oversaw the creation of two general improvement districts to assist with underground utilities. She developed a long-range financial plan, administered the city's sales and use tax program, coordinated the city's annual audit, and created a budget document which won an award for 8 consecutive years. She is a Colorado native and graduated from Colorado State University with a Bachelor's of Science in Business Administration. I'll do one more short article before I turn it back over to Doug. Man faces charges for fleeing. This is written by Tom Lowy. A Bettendorf man faces 2 felony and 13 misdemeanor charges for allegedly fleeing a traffic stop on Sunday. Iowa State Patrol attempted to pull over Jacob W. Shin, age 34, at 9:32 p.m. on Sunday near East 31st Street and Jersey Ridge Road for driving a stolen white Kia Sportage with no plates, court records state. He faces felony charges of eluding and second-degree theft. According to the ISP report, Shin fled the scene in the Sportage, exceeded posted speed limits by more than 24 miles per hour, and failed to obey a number of traffic control devices. The report also said Shin fled the Sportage on foot while it was moving near the intersection of East Locust Street and Bridge Avenue. He was taken into custody by ISP officers after a foot chase. ISP officers said the Sportage did not have a registration plate affixed to the rear, and there was a white piece of paper which was intended to look like an Iowa DOT driveaway tag. The paper was clearly fraudulent as it was homemade, the quote says about that. It was later determined the Sportage was reported stolen out of Davenport. A check of the Shin's driving status through the Iowa DOT revealed him to be revoked for OWI from May 17th of 2018 until May 14th of 2024. His license was also suspended. Shin was allegedly found with THC cartridges, leading to misdemeanor charges of possession of a controlled substance.
And one more story here, kind of along the same line. It's locally, East Moline man found unfit for trial. Newton was charged with child sex crime, written by Anthony Watt. A Rock Island County judge has found unfit an East Moline man accused of indecent solicitation of a child. Prosecutors filed the charge against Michael S. Newton, 53 years old, in January, according to court records. Underlying the charge is the allegation that on January 6, he knowingly solicited for sex someone he thought was a juvenile. The East Moline Police Department investigated the case, court records state. Authorities opened the case against Newton on January 8. And on January 23, Judge Peter Church ordered a fitness evaluation after doubts were raised about Newton's ability to participate in the case. Judge Frank Fuhrer found Newton unfit on March 13, and Newton remained so as of April 10, according to court records. The 11-year-old East Moline child authorities alleged Newton thought he was contacting did not exist, according to court records. The Facebook account of the child was created by a Texas-based group known as Predator Proachers, court records state. Members of the group later told East Moline investigators that its purpose is to help law enforcement locate and identify child predators, court records state. Newton began contacting the fake account, and his messages soon became sexual in nature, authorities allege in court records state again. On several occasions, he proposed he and the child have sex. Court records state Newton arranged to meet the child in East Moline and was confronted by members of Predator Poachers. Newton admitted to the members of the group that his intent was to meet the child and have sex with her, court records state. Group then contacted the East Moline Police Department and turned over copies of the messages between Newton and the fake account. Records state that after police Mirandized Newton, he admitted to a police detective that his intent was to meet the 11-year-old and have sex with her. Shortly after prosecutors filed the charge against Newton, they petitioned to have him detained, court records state. And after a hearing on that petition, Church ordered that Newton remain in custody at the Rock Island County Jail rather than be freed on pretrial release. As of Friday, Newton had not yet been transferred to the custody of the Department of Human Services for treatment and remained in county custody, according to the jail website. His next court hearing has been set for May 8, court records state, and I thought I would read this last one here. I don't get to read these very often. I thought I'd try this one. The best thing I ate on the local page here. Food trucks Jalisco Burrito satisfies. Cocina Verde. I'm in trouble already. This Cocina Verde offers vegan Mexican food. I'd never heard a tornado siren before. A real one, that is. I've heard the test siren since moving to the Midwest, but never a real one. There aren't tornadoes in Nevada. Just dust devils and tumbleweeds and haboobs. On my way home from the office last week, my phone told me to seek first floor shelter as soon as possible, as the Quad Cities faced a tornado warning. Sky turned green. Above it all, I was hungry. I called my girlfriend to make plans for the storm. Given that our apartment is not on the first floor, we weren't quite sure what to do. We're both desert rats who had never seen all this Dorothy on her way to Oz business. So I told her to meet me at Crawford Brew Works, a brewery in Bettendorf. I knew that on Tuesday nights, Crawford has a recurring day. An entirely vegan Mexican food spot with delicious burritos and elote. If there's one thing I do understand, and as a transplant, is beer and Mexican food. Despite the tornado warning, it felt something like home. As we arrived, the tornado siren started. The folks in the food truck laughed it off nonchalantly, and I ordered onward, picking a dish I'd gotten a few weeks before that's become a favorite, the Jalisco Burrito. As you've probably noticed in this column, I don't follow a vegetarian or vegan diet. I love steak, chicken, shrimp, and pork too much to ever give up. I forgot to tell you, it's written by Gannon Havnevold. But my girlfriend is a pescatarian, so I indulge in the meatless lifestyle from time to time. Normally, I'm hesitant about meat alternatives that claim to be similar to the real thing, but I tell you what, Cocina Verde has it down. The Jalisco at Cocina Verde is their alternative to traditional carne asada. You can order it in a taco or burrito. I got it in a burrito, which comes with guacamole, rice, pinto beans, lettuce, tomato, and sour cream inside a flour tortilla. Cocina Verde uses plant-based dairy alternatives, including those made with nuts. The Jalisco meat alternative is dense and packed with spice. If you're looking for some extra punch, Cocina Verde also offers a red and green salsa with each burrito. I'm personally more of a green fan. Verde is a name, after all. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. The burritos at Cocina Verde cost $14.50, an expected uptick from a typical food truck burrito with traditional meat. I can assure you it's worth it. The first time I tried a Jalisco burrito, I finished it with ease. This time around, as tornado sirens blared outside and rain pounded the ceiling, I could eat only about two-thirds. If you're looking for lighter fare, they have street tacos that come in threes with your choice of Jalisco, Abodo, similar to Al Pastor, or Garbanzo. Because Cocina Verde is a taco truck, its location isn't set in stone. On Tuesdays from 5 to 8 p.m., it's at Crawford Brew Works, located at 3659 Devil's Glen Road in Bettendorf. Other than that, it stops very, so I recommend staying up to a date on its Facebook page. Past stops have included St. Ambrose University and Poor Brothers Tap Room in Moline. The food truck is Cocina Verde food truck. Its bright green extra cannot be missed, exterior cannot be missed, and its chalkboard menu is simplistic and easy to navigate. Service is always extremely friendly, and they even offer buzzers allowing you to head inside while you wait for food to be ready. Because of the vegan menu, it's impossible to leave Cocina Verde without feeling a little bit lighter than you typically might after street food. Yes, even during an intimidating storm. On their Crawford days, you can bring your burrito or tacos inside the brewery dining area to eat and try a beer. Crawford also has a variety of board games available in case you want to kill some time with a date or your family. That's exactly what I did when it was time to get away from the windows. Call it fear or my desert heart, but I wasn't messing around with those storms outside. I grabbed a board game, Yahtzee, and my girlfriend and I hunkered down with delicious, healthy burritos and the kind staff of Crawford and Cocina Verde. That felt like a safer and tastier a dice rolled and going in our first tornado warning alone. Dale?
You are listening to the Quad City Times on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And it is now time for the obituaries from the Quad City Times. Roger Larry Schemmel, age 84, a resident of Davenport, died peacefully on April 21st at Clarissa Cook Hospice House. Visitation will be at the Runge Mortuary on Thursday, April 25th at 11 a.m., with the service immediately following at noon. Burial will be at Memorial Park Cemetery. Roger was born on October 20, 1939, in Chester, South Dakota, the son of Rudy and Vera Nagel Schemmel. He married his high school sweetheart, Julia Mae Kalaus, on April 4, 1959, in Davenport. They were blessed with 5 children and 61 years of marriage before her death on August 17, 2020. Roger retired from Alcoa after 36 years of working in the foil mill. He then worked part-time at Rivermont Collegiate as a custodian for 3 years. Roger served in the National Guard, and he enjoyed planting and harvest season at Gladys and Allen Plambeck's farm, fishing the local casinos, scratch tickets, playing any card games, driving antique tractors at the fair, and the NASCAR pool that many children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren participated in. He was Julie's caregiver for the 12 years she battled dementia, and he lived independently with Parkinson's disease until a March 4, 2024 fall at his home. Over the years, he and Julie enjoyed square dancing, gardening, camping, and the many vacations to Wisconsin, Florida, Hawaii, California, and Rocky Mountain National Park. But mostly, he enjoyed the smile on Julie's face while spending time with his family. Memorials may be made to Clarissa Cook's Hospice House. The family would like to thank the staff at Genesis Health, Cardiac Stepdown and Pulmonary Units, Call Home, and Clarissa Cook Hospice House for their care in his final days. Online condolences and remembrances may be expressed to the family at therungemortuary.com. Craig A. Stang, age 64, of Waukon, Iowa, lost his battle to cancer Friday, April 19th at Mayo Clinic Health Systems in La Crosse, Wisconsin. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. In lieu of flowers, please send memorials to Cody Stang, S-T-A-N-G-E. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that right. At 501 Floyd Street in Sanborn, Iowa, 51248, for a memorial that will be set up at a later date to benefit an outdoor enthusiast. Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is handling arrangements. Craig, also known as Gravy Alan Stang, was born August 3, 1959 in Marion, Iowa, the son of Marlon and Rita Etheridge Stang. He graduated from Davenport West High School in 1978. On May 9, 1986, he married Deborah Blair in Walcott, Iowa. The couple moved to Georgia, and to this marriage, they were blessed with son Cody. The two later divorced. Craig found his home in Northeast Iowa. He spent his life working in the construction industry and worked in maintenance at Cabela's in Prairie du Chien in Wisconsin for 19 years. Craig was hardworking with an unmatched work ethic. Craig enjoyed trapping and was an avid hunter of deer, mushrooms, and ginseng. He loved demolition derbies and stock car racing. Craig also liked watching football, especially the Kansas City Chiefs and NASCAR. Craig could often be found helping out a friend. Online condolences may be left at the website martinfunerals.com. Shirley Schmidt Newberry, age 79, of West Plains, Missouri, formerly of Bluegrass, Iowa, went to meet the Lord on April 16th after she lost her battle with cancer. Visitation will be Thursday, April 25th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Runge Mortuary and Crematory. She was born to Eleanor Junkman first and then Johnson and Raymond Schmidt on July 20th in 1944. She married Dan Smith, with whom they had 3 children, Jeff, Barry, and Jason. After their divorce, Shirley met the love of her life, Jim Newberry, whom she married in May of 2000. Jim and Shirley spent many joyful years camping, canoeing, swimming, ATV riding, playing cards and games, gardening, and spending time with family and friends. Shirley is preceded in death by her parents. She is survived by her loving husband of 24 years, Jim, and her sons. May she rest in peace.
Carol Jean Hunt Guzzo, G-U-Z-Z-O, 69 years old at Davenport, will greet friends, the family of Carol Jean, will greet friends and relatives at a visitation on Friday, April 26, from 4 to 7 p.m. Memorial services will be Saturday, April 27, at 11 a.m. Memorial services and visitation will be at McGinnis Chambers Funeral Home, 644 River Drive in Bettendorf. Interment services will follow at Davenport Memorial Park Cemetery and Mausoleum, Davenport. Carol passed away Monday, the 15th of April at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. A special thanks goes to many friends and family that came to visit and comfort Carol in her final days. Special thanks to the doctors, nurses, chaplains, campuses, hospital nurses, staff, and musical therapists at the University Hospital. They assisted her with excellent care, compassion, and professionalism in her final days on earth. She was welcomed by our Lord and joined the other angels in heaven that have gone before her. Carol Jean Allen was born April 1, 1955 in Maqueda, Maquoketa, Iowa, the daughter of Walter and Darlene Newman Allen. She grew up in Monmouth, Iowa, and graduated from Midland Community School in 1973. She married Courtney P. Hunt on August 14, 1982 in Pleasant Valley, Iowa. He preceded her in death on February 7 after reconnecting with Samuel Guzzo at a school reunion later in 2015. They became inseparable and fell in love. They were married at Our Lady of Victory Catholic Church April 3, 2021. Carol attended Stewart School of Hairstyling in 1974. She worked as a cosmetologist hairstylist for over 10 years. And Carol worked as an educational aide for the Pleasant Valley School District for 14 years, retired in 2014 to take care of her husband at home. During her time as teacher's aide at Pleasant Valley Schools and afterwards, she took care of Ryan Bubbers. She took pride and was honored to have special bond with Ryan, a severely handicapped boy. Carol's greatest joy, love in life was her friend, family, was her family, I mean. She proudly loved being a wife, a mom, a Grammy, and a farm kid. She grew up on a farm and loved animals, especially her family dog, Lady, and Holstein cows. Memorials may be made to the Ronald McDonald House. Online condolences may be shared with the family at McGinnisChambers.com. And our final one today is Virginia Merchant, 96 years old, of Bettendorf, passed away Saturday, the 20th of April. Funeral services are 10 a.m. Friday, April 26, Gethsemane Lutheran Church in Davenport. Visitation 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, April 25, at Whelan Presley Funeral Home and Crematory, Rock Island. Burial will be in Oak Knoll Cemetery, Sterling, Illinois. Virginia was born January 22 in Carroll County, Illinois, to Henry and Anna Miller Appel. Surviving are her daughters Peggy Winstrom, Jill Clark, and Karen Henry. 5 grandchildren and 5 great-grandchildren. Unkind condolences may be left at WhelanPresley.com. Okay, well, let me...
Thank you, Doug. It is now time for the opinion page from the Quad City Times. Let's see. I'm going to start with another view, and this is from the Virginian Pilot newspaper. The headline is, Biden's train safety rule isn't enough. And so this isn't from the editorial staff at the Virginian Pilot. The environmental disaster caused by a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio last year should have spurred federal lawmakers to take seriously the need to improve rail safety. But a measure passed by the Senate languishes in a House that struggles to accomplish anything of consequence. A Biden administration rule approved this month will require 2-person crews on freight trains. That's a good start, but it's a poor substitute for comprehensive action by Congress that would ensure that railways continue to safely serve as arteries for American commerce. A Norfolk Southern train derailed last year when a wheel bearing overheated to a dangerous degree, and crew members were unable to stop the 1.75-mile-long train before 28 cars derailed. 11 carried toxic chemicals that spilled into area waterways. A controversial decision to release and burn some of the remaining chemicals sent dangerous smoke into the area, and hundreds of nearby residents were temporarily displaced. The East Palestine disaster was one of nearly 300 derailments and other accidents on freight lines between January 1st and November 30th of last year. Investigators cite numerous factors that could have prevented these accidents, from having more crew operating trains increasingly dependent on automation to installing additional sensors to identify problems such as overheating. In the aftermath, Ohio Senators, Democrat Sherrod Brown and Republican J.D. Vance, collaborated on legislation that would increase rail inspections, strengthen rules for handling hazardous chemicals, and require the installation of more sensors. It passed the chamber in May. In the House, however, this sensible legislation hit a roadblock. The lower chamber has done precious little work since it convened in January 2023, and even bills such as this, which would improve the safety of a critical transportation network and, in doing so, protect American commerce, failed to move to the floor. Freight rail traffic is essential to the American economy, driving billions in commerce and generating more than 167,000 jobs, according to the Federal Railroad Administration. The importance of railways operating safely and smartly cannot be overstated, and it's critical in places such as Hampton Roads, where operations at the Port of Virginia depend on them. Communities such as East Palestine, where residents are still struggling with the effects of last year's derailment, shouldn't be sacrificed to pad the bank accounts of railway company shareholders. Improving the safety of American rail traffic needs to be a priority in Washington. The House must follow the Senate's lead and pass this legislation before the next disaster occurs.
And wolf elimination policy has led to torture and darkness is another opinion written by Kathleen Parker, who writes for the Washington Post. The alleged torture and killing of an adolescent female wolf earlier this year in Wyoming has brought international outrage, a demand that the perpetrator be incarcerated and policies reformed to prevent any more cruelty to predators. When it comes to wolves in Wyoming, where wildlife is plentiful and people are scarce, it's open season. 24/7/365. No license is required in predator zones, which cover 85% of the state. In 2021, the Republican-led legislature passed a law calling for the extermination of 90% of the state's gray wolves. The state also protects hunters' identities because of a 2012 law passed after the harassment of an Idaho wolf hunter whose name had been posted online. It's not hard to see how such standards for killing could lead someone such as Cody Roberts, 42 years old, to think it would be fun to mow down an adolescent female wolf with a 600-pound snowmobile, then drag her through a bar in Daniel, Wyoming, and then pose for photos. This is what Roberts allegedly did on the night of February 29. He taped the agonized wolf's jaws shut, shocked her repeatedly with a shock collar, according to witnesses, and then dragged her outside where he shot her. Well, maybe not so easy for decent people to see. I've been trying to unsee for several days so I could bring myself to write about this barbarism. Videos and photographs quickly circulated around town and online showing Roberts kneeling and grimacing as he held up the suffering animal and a celebratory beer. Outraged animal welfare activists worldwide have spread the word about Roberts and the obscene fate of a grievously wounded animal. Yet Roberts was fined just $250 for illegal possession of live, warm-blooded wildlife, which, Hail Mary, is against the law. I'm glad something is. Nowhere near satisfied, animal welfare groups are offering a a $20,000 reward for anyone providing additional evidence to police and prosecutors that leads to Roberts spending at least 1 year in prison. Wayne Bissell, president of the Center for a Humane Economy, also has given the poor wolf a name, Thea, for the Greek goddess of light, sight, and prophecy, so that she will be remembered as the noble creature whose sacrifice will drive a movement toward more humane policies. To this end, the Center for a Humane Economy and other groups are calling for a ban on using snowmobiles to run down and crush animals, the abolition of Wyoming's predator zones, and bans on the use of hunting dogs, wire snares, and steel-jawed leghold traps. If Roberts has a reason to feel he did nothing wrong, it is the lax Wyoming laws that have created a wolf-hunting free-for-all. But really, what kind of state allows people to run over animals with a snowmobile? This is a rhetorical question, obviously. I reached out to Roberts by phone but got no answer. A legal analyst by the center suggests Roberts still could be prosecuted under the state's animal cruelty statute, which provides for felony-level penalties. But Wyoming officials disagree, saying that cruelty laws don't apply to predatory species defined beyond wolves as coyotes, red fox, stray cats, jackrabbits, porcupines, raccoons, and striped skunk. Theoretically, under current state law, all such animals could be tortured with impunity. Officialdom has been annoyingly mum on policy related to wolves. In its first public statement about the Roberts incident, Wyoming Game and Fish officials cited a state law that they contend says any information regarding wolves taken in Wyoming is not public record. This applies even to wolves killed in neighboring states. Wyoming hunters have killed Colorado wolves that wander too close to the border and also have lured wolves into their state to be killed. Wyoming refuses to share wolf information with Colorado and reports only the aggregate number killed. Colorado operates differently. Last year, it implemented a program voted on in 2020 to reintroduce wolves in the state where once they were plentiful. Citizens apparently understand the valuable role wolves play in the ecosystem, as do at least some folks in Wyoming. There's never any excuse for torturing any animal under any circumstances. Roberts deserves to be punished for the sake of justice and as a warning to others. Wyoming Governor Mark Gordon, a Republican, has condemned Roberts' actions, but for Thea's sake and the sake of our shared humanity, let's hope national authorities move quickly.
I will turn now to the sports section of the Quad City Times. The headline at the top of the page is about the Quad Cities River Bandits. This is written by Tom Johnston, and the headline says, Bandits enjoying fast start. Quad Cities River Bandits relief pitcher Brandon Johnson says he can sense something special brewing for the local Class A Midwest League franchise this season. It's funny, when we came into this year in the first meeting, some of the players talked and we said that this is going to be Vibe City, not just Quad Cities, said the 23-year-old Alabama native who is off to a 3-0 start. We want the vibes as high as they can possibly be, end quote. So far, the vibes have been on high frequency in the young 2024 season. The 11-4 River Bandits jumped to the top of the Western Division standings thanks to a 9-game winning streak that was snapped with a 4-2 loss setback on Sunday afternoon to Peoria. Still, the best start in the MWL has been solid. It's been nice to get off to a good start, said QC manager Brooks Conrad, whose last two Quad City clubs have struggled putting wins on the board. This good start, though, has been fun to see by the manager. It kind of validates what we're here trying to do, he said. Make no mistake, we're here to develop and get you guys better. But when you cross those lines, the goal is to win every night. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. What the losing streak is. We're here today, and the goal is to win that night. We don't want to vary from that. We've been playing pretty good team baseball, said infielder Jack Pineda during that win streak. everyone has stepped up and done their jobs. The pitching staff has been carrying much of the load so far as the offense tries to get the bats warmed up. Quad Cities goes into an extended road trip to South Bend and Beloit, 11th in the 12-team league in runs. Okay. with 57 in 14 games, an average of just over 4 runs per game. Quad Cities is also batting just 190 with runners in scoring position and ranks 10th in most offensive categories, but leads the MWL with 6 triples. Conrad said, "The bats haven't broken out like I think they really can." His team carries a .225 batting average that is worst in the league. Once that happens, he says, it's going to be really good. Quad City pitchers have been phenomenal out of the gate, ranking either first or second in every major pitching category except walks allowed, where they were fourth with 53. Conrad continued, "Obviously, pitching has been our biggest highlight. Our pitchers are the reason we're where we're at right now. At this point in the season, we haven't strung together hit after hit after hit and put up a lot of big innings and big numbers and struggled with runners in scoring position overall, I think. But we've been able to manufacture enough, and our pitchers have given us a chance to stay in the games," he said. Overall, the skipper has been happy with the product on the field and the players as they adapt to the new season. He continued, "I like their competitiveness, and I like that they're really taking that to heart. The goal is to win every night, and they are interested in doing that. I like the way that they prepare. I like their aggressiveness on the bases." Quad City leads the MWL in stolen bases with 36 and caught stealing with 11. On the road, Quad City embarks on its first of two-week road trips on Tuesday. The Bandits are in South Bend for 6 games and then follow that with another 6-pack in Beloit. A difference for this trip is that the team will stay on the road for all 13 days as opposed to breaking up the trip with a return home in the middle. Conrad said this isn't a new approach. His quote, "If it's close enough to come home for a day, we will. Sometimes we come home and sometimes we don't. It just depends on where we are." The extended road stays are usually necessitated by visits to Eastern Division teams that require longer bus trips. Conrad said, "If you just have to pack a few more clothes, he said, in dealing with the day-to-day logistics of an extended trip, that's about the only difference. It's still 12 baseball games that we have to go compete in and try to win." And finally, on streaking. While the team's 9-game winning streak was snapped, one QC player is still working on an individual streak as this road trip commences. Pitcher Ben Kudrna, one of Kansas City's top young prospects, shook off a shaky season opener with 2 stellar outings in which he has pitched 11 straight shutout innings. He is scheduled to pitch again on Wednesday. And catcher Carter Jensen had 2 impressive streaks end this past weekend. He had a nine-game hitting streak going and had reached safely in 13 straight before going 0-for-4 in Saturday's 3-1 victory over Peoria.
And on the air, if you're interested, at 6 tonight, Clemson's at Georgia, ESPNU. And at 8, UC Irvine at UCLA, Pac-12N. College softball, Iowa's at Nebraska, BTN at 4. And again, must be a doubleheader. They're at Nebraska at 6:30. They do it again. And Virginia at Virginia Tech, ACCN. This is college softball. Houston at Texas A&M, SECN. Major League Baseball, if you're interested. Houston at Chicago Cubs, 6:30. Marquee TBS, 6:40. You'll find Chicago White Sox at Minnesota. NBCSCH at 6:45. You'll find Arizona at St. Louis, BSMW. NBA playoffs, 6:30. Game 2, Phoenix at Minnesota, TNT. 7:30, Game 2, Indiana at Milwaukee, NBA TV. At 9, Game 2, Dallas at LA Clippers, TNT. And that's Game 2. NHL playoffs, if you're a hockey fan, you've got Game 2, Washington at New York Rangers, ESPN, 6. 6:30, Game 2, Tampa Bay at Florida, ESPN 2. 8:30, Game 2, Colorado at Winnipeg, that's ESPN. And at 9, Game 2, Nashville at Vancouver, ESPN 2. Not to leave out soccer, 2 p.m. today, I guess. Premier League, Chelsea at Arsenal, USA. 9 o'clock, Champions Cup semifinal. Oh boy, Pachuca at Club America, FS1. And finally, tennis, you got your 4 a.m. Madrid and then 4 a.m. tennis. That's kind of early. I'm going to turn it back to Dale.
I'm going to give you one more little story before I finish up here. Brecht earns weekly Big Ten award. The University of Iowa pitcher Brody Brecht has been named the Big Ten co-pitcher of the week for the third time in his career. The junior right-hander from Ankeny struck out 12 Rutgers batters in 7 2/3 innings as the Hawkeyes swept Rutgers with a 5-1 win on Sunday. Brecht allowed one unearned run on one hit. Brecht, who is 1-2, ranks number 3 in the country in strikeouts per inning with 15.75. He holds an ERA of 4.12 with 84 strikeouts in 48 innings. And the Hawkeyes are 22-15 overall, 9-6 in the Big Ten. They host Milwaukee, who is 10-26, on Tuesday at 6:05. That brings us to the end of the Quad City Times for today. I'm Dale Finnegan, and my partner at the microphone has been Doug Kretzinger. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.